case for today, which is Masuda against Panda Express and others.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Shum, and I represent Dr. Fortuné Masuda in this appeal.
Be sure to speak up just so we can hear you.
Yes, Your Honor. At bottom, if Panda's arguments are accepted, then the Delaware corporate form is essentially a license to steal for the controlling shareholder.
But that's a broad statement, and I guess what I'm concerned about looking at the Thule decision of the Delaware court is it does seem to me that Masuda's claim arises because of her status as a shareholder. Now, sometimes that's enough to give somebody the right to proceed independently, particularly if, let's say, as a majority shareholder, you're arguing about vote dilution, for example. But that doesn't seem to be the theory that you have. It seems to be really just an economic loss theory, which would have flowed backwards through these various organizations and maybe eventually reached her.
It's not an economic loss theory. It's an expropriation theory, whereby the controlling shareholder expropriates a company's asset for his exclusive benefit.
But it's the company that's hurt, isn't it? It's PE Chicago that's hurt.
That is correct. Essentially, it's a quasi-claim where the company may have a claim, but the shareholder also has a claim. This was directly addressed by the Delaware Supreme Court in the Gatz case. And what they said in that case is that a separate harm, and I'm citing at 925 A2nd at 1278, and they're citing the Gentile-Rosette case. And what they say is that a separate harm also results. The public or minority shareholders are entitled to recover the value represented by that overpayment or economic loss directly and without regard to any other claim that the corporation may have.
But the Gentile case is really a different set of facts. I mean, the conversion rate has changed. It changes the structure of the corporation. The minority shareholders do have a dilution, whereas here the company is the holder of whatever rights there are. Now, the company winds up settling its rights, so we will never know exactly how much PE could have PE Chicago could have gotten. But I think this case looks different from Gentile.
It does look different from Gentile, and it also looks different from Gatz, because that's what they said in the Gatz case. And they said, well, this is a different set of circumstances. There's no overpayment of shares. There's no vote dilution. They said what they did was a very complicated two-step transaction to avoid Gentile. And what the Delaware Supreme Court said in Gatz was, we're not looking at the form. We're looking at the substance. The key issue involved is whether or not the minority shareholders are harmed by the expropriation and
in a way different from the harm to the corporation. Certainly, are you harmed at a pragmatic level? Sure. You know, if the corporation in which you have an 11% stake is looted, then you're not going to have 11% of anything much. But the cause of action belongs to the corporation.
And that's where we dovetail into the judicial estoppel argument. Because if it's different. The issue of harm in Thule is defined as who is entitled to relief.
Mm-hmm.
That is the issue of harm. Who is entitled to relief is the merits of the claim, as the Seventh Circuit has stated, the difference between.
But I think you're jumping too quickly. Certainly, who is entitled to relief? This comes up in lots of areas of law. It comes up in corporate law a lot. It comes up in antitrust law. You know, who is the right party to be asserting the claim in any given situation? Sometimes, you know, it's the company. Maybe sometimes it's investors in the company. Maybe sometimes it's employees. Maybe sometimes it's others, creditors maybe. But usually it's going to be the company if you've got a complex situation like that. And just because the company has the right to assert claims, whatever they may be, doesn't mean the claims are necessarily going to succeed. So you can't say every time a company asserts a claim and fails, then automatically somebody else must have standing to assert the same claim. It's just a merits determination.
That's true, but in this situation, let's take that to the conclusion, accepting again all of Panda's arguments. What we would have is, and what they said in the prior case, the Serrazzi case, they argued to the court that PE Chicago could not sue because of its participation in the transaction. So the company has no claim. Those were dismissed. What they argue here is,
they didn't say it's not entitled to. There was a defense, essentially, against its assertion of a right, which was more or less an unclean hands defense. But it doesn't mean they were the wrong entity, seems to me.
And that's the tricky part of this. That's the distinction that really makes a difference. Because a derivative suit means it's the company's claim, not the shareholder's claim.
Exactly.
Because if we had to do what they're asking us to do, what we would do is Rule 23.1, ask the corporation to sue on our behalf, and the same result would result. Because of PE Chicago's participation in the transaction, all our tort claims are tossed out. I mean, these kind of arguments are used all the time as a sword and a shield. In the underlying Serrazzi case, they said, Mr. Serrazzi, this is a derivative claim. You should bring it derivatively. And then when that was denied, and PE Chicago was added to the case and tried to assert the same claims that they said PE Chicago should have asserted in the first place, they said PE Chicago doesn't have the ability to assert those claims because it participated in the transaction. So it's really a circular argument.
But that's not a capacity argument. That, as I said, that just means there's a defense to liability, and unclean hands is recognized as a defense, again, in a wide variety of contexts.
Correct, but if that's the case, that means a minority shareholder has no redress whatsoever.
She could have gone through the demand procedure, and you may be right that it would have been futile, in which case, but we don't have that case in front of us. This is not a case where you say you should be excused from demand.
That is correct. And again, that kind of leads to the second argument, which is the judicial estoppel argument. Because you can't argue that the company doesn't have a claim, and you can't argue in this case now and win on that, and then we bring a separate claim on behalf of the minority shareholder directly and say, well, that was the company claim all along. But before we get there, I think there's an even more important distinction, which is that in the Gentil line of cases where you've got the controlling shareholder expropriates an asset for his or her own benefit, and the minority shareholder's voting power is diluted in any way, that is explicitly a separate right, direct right, for minority shareholders, regardless of a company's claim. Now, here we don't have a complicated formula of overpayment of shares or recapitalization. Here we have just outright fraud. I mean, there's a reason there's probably not a lot of civil law in this. What he did was he didn't dilute her voting power. He nullified it. He never gave her a chance to even say anything or do anything. The corporation acted at his behest alone. And that, and under the clear language of the Delaware Supreme Court precedent on this kind of an issue, this expropriation allows for a direct claim because otherwise the minority shareholder really is without redress.
But the district court found that on the fraud side of things, you focus on whether the who, where, and how was pleaded. Let's assume it was. But the district court also says that the complaint fails to raise properly that you intended the plaintiff to act on the basis of the false statement, that there was actual reliance, that the damages were the result of that reliance. I mean, there's more to it than just who said what when.
That's true.
And there's no response, so I feel like there's a gap here.
That's true, Your Honor. I think, you know, separately, because the fraud doesn't deal with who has the right to bring a claim. The fraud claim was based on a specific statement made by Panda to our client and
her husband.
Right, the
general counsel said,
exactly right.
Your stock is worthless.
Exactly right. And on this point, what I would say is, well, I mean, we did say what date it was, who we talked to, how it was done.
But it's the other elements that the judge also says you didn't touch.
Yes, and perhaps we could have pled it clearer, but I would say this. What we have pled is a fraudulent transfer as a matter of Illinois law under Kennedy Boys Services and for your use only, an opinion by this court. So what I would say is that I think the allegations as they exist and the inferences to be drawn therefrom would show that, hey, we are suing Tony Rizko. Do you want to buy our shares? And that's exactly why it's a fraudulent transfer as a matter of law. I understand the standards are different, but we tried a fraud claim on these essentially exact facts without a statement to Mr. Serrazzi in that case, and a jury awarded significant punitive damages on the conspiracy to defraud. I didn't mean to finish your sentence, I just have a question
I wanted to get it before you go.
All I was just saying is I understand fraudulent transfer and common law fraud are different standards, but I would just suggest that the allegations would at least support an inference that a fraud had occurred.
Well, you tried the case with, what's his name, Ferrizzi?
Serrazzo, Your Honor, yes. Yeah.
And when did Ms. Masuda come along?
She came along after the jury returned a verdict in that case.
What I'm worried about is on the settlement.
Yes.
Where everybody's released.
Yes.
Including P.E.
Yes.
So how is she going to be able to come in when P.E. is the one that must have, I guess, got whatever money
P.E.
she was entitled to?
The reason that P.E. Chicago was still in that case at all was because it had a breach of contract claim. All of P.E. Chicago's tort claims were dismissed at summary judgment.
Where did the money go? What's his name, the first guy that sold out?
Serrazzo?
The famous guy.
Yeah.
Oh, Resco. Resco.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He got away with a little over $3 million, apparently, and sold for a greatly reduced price and all that.
Yes.
And then Serrazzi comes in and gets the big verdict about a punitive damages and some other things, and then that's what the settlement negotiations were all about in the release.
That's right. It was a settlement of claims, but you're right.
Isn't that release pretty much block her out?
It does not, and it does not specifically because that is addressed in the citation I gave, which says that regardless of whatever claims a corporation has, even if you say P. Chicago has claims, even if you say that Panda is not judicially estopped, that's separate. This is a specific claim to her, and the claim involves what she is allowed to bring a claim based on how much the controlling shareholder was unjustly enriched versus how much minority shareholders were harmed. And that's
basically the same claim against Panda that you had before then.
It is, yes, on many of the same things.
And that's
yes.
What I'm concerned about a little bit is maybe that release cut the second client out, but maybe you weren't aware of her at that time, so maybe that's not an issue.
Well, it's not the same claims we brought before because those claims were gone. By the time we got to the settlement agreement, those claims were not asserted, or they were out of the case, and they had been dismissed.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Dussault?
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. Chris Dussault of Gibson Dunn on behalf of the appellees. Your Honors, this is a case in which an indirect shareholder of a company is seeking to relitigate claims that were already brought, settled, and released by the company itself. She does so with the same lawyers stating the same claims, purporting to, and basing her claims on precisely the same harms, which are harms to the company.
Can I ask you something about the settlement money? Did any of the funds go to individual shareholders of P.E. Chicago?
It's a great question, Your Honor, that we don't know the answer to. So P.E. Chicago settled its claims. Counsel is incorrect that the settlement didn't cover these claims. The settlement was as to all the claims, including the claims that we had won on in the district court. A substantial payment was made to P.E. Chicago. To the extent Dr. Masuda is an 11% shareholder indirectly in P.E. Chicago, presumably she would get...
She's actually a shareholder in Enterprises,
she
right?
Is, and she's saying, therefore, she has an indirect 11% interest.
Because so, Enterprise 100% owns or controls P.E. Chicago,
correct.
Is that
That's
correct?
That's the allegation, yes. But I think it's a critical point here. The suggestion that she is somehow left without recourse is totally false. If she has an indirect 11% interest in P.E. Chicago, P.E. Chicago brought its claims. P.E. Chicago chose to accept a compensation in a settlement. She may well have received 11% of that after the settlement. We don't know that. If she didn't, her claim is against P.E. Chicago. What the law does not allow is for her, with the same lawyers, within a month after the settlement papers are inked, to come in and try and litigate exactly the same claims. She's not allowed to do that.
That's what concerns me about a release.
Yes. P.E. Chicago owns these claims. The fact that the claims are without merit is beside the point. They have the claims. They settled for what they deemed to be the fair value, and then they released it. She is not allowed to then bring their claims when they have already been released. And these claims, this is the central issue on the appeal, these claims are, under Delaware law, not her claims. They are P.E. Chicago's claims. Because the Thule Court says the way you determine who owns the claim, whether it's derivative or direct, is two questions. To whom is the harm done, and who would get the recovery in this case? The Thule Court also says that a direct shareholder claim must be independent of the harm to the company And I think this is critical in this case, the plaintiff would have to be able to prove her claims without showing injury to the company. The harms that are alleged by Dr. Masuda, and it's not coincidental that they're exactly the same harms that were alleged by PE Chicago, is that PE Chicago didn't get a fair value for its asset, and that money that should have gone into the PE Chicago bank account instead went into a personal bank account.
Not just any personal bank account, but yes, a personal bank account. So do you think that the direct claims are limited to voting dilution claims? What other kind of direct claim would a shareholder be able to bring?
It's not necessarily limited to voter dilution claims, and even the Gentile case says this is one exception that's been recognized. But what you would have to have is something that is truly independent. And so let's talk about Gentile for a moment, because I think Gentile is correctly decided. In Gentile, the court said, yes, there's a harm to the company where you have an issuance of stock that the company isn't paid for. But if in the same transaction you have a transfer of both voting power and economic power from one shareholder to another, you know, from a minority to a controlling, that's a harm independent of harm to the company. And I think it's very easy to conceive. There might be a situation where the company is indifferent to a majority shareholder increasing his or her share. In fact, if that majority shareholder has great business acumen, is very hardworking, the company might prefer that. But it's a direct harm through the allocation of voting and economic rights in the stock that the shareholder is asserting. There's nothing like that in this case, nothing at all, and nothing that would satisfy Tooley. There's no issuance of stock alleged. There's no reference to the word voting or voting rights. In fact, the record does include the partnership agreement of PE Chicago, which shows that it was agreed by Dr. Masuda that Mr. Rezko's entity concessions would have complete control over the business of PE Chicago.
But what she does seem to be trying to say is that the allocation of economic benefit from PE Chicago at the shareholder level was misallocated, was distorted somehow. She should have gotten a piece of the pie, basically, not just Mr. Sirazi.
Sure, and in virtually any waste of corporate assets case, you're going to have exactly the same thing. If somebody comes to the court and says, this major shareholder gave himself a sweetheart golden parachute, or this shareholder gave himself, you know, stock options, you could always say, well, that benefits one shareholder and didn't benefit me. That's not what the Gentile case or the Gatz case stand for.
Well, why should we restrict Gentile's holding to cases involving just a change in voting power? Why shouldn't its holding also apply to all cases where the majority shareholder benefits at the expense of minority shareholders?
Well, I think the reason that, and it's not you, I would say, who should limit it, I think it's the Delaware Supreme Court that's already limited it in the Gentile line, is that it is when you have voting and economic power at the shareholder level that the claim can possibly satisfy the Tooley standard, because it's independent and because the plaintiff could win on that claim without showing harm to the company. In this case, where she's saying nothing more than the corporate waste helped one shareholder more than me, how on earth does she satisfy the Tooley standard that you be able to prove your case without harm to the company?
So you're saying, you're imagining that the company, just to very much oversimplify, has a constant number of dollars in assets, and the only thing that's going on is below that level where the allocation is changing, whether economic benefit or voting rights. And in that instance, the company doesn't really care. The company's not hurt, but perhaps there's some inter-se problem
with
the shareholders.
I think, Your Honor, just to clarify a little bit, I think the question is put this way. Are you looking at a reallocation of rights at the stockholder level or a recovery of consideration at the corporate level?
Right.
And if somebody does something with stock that makes their stock more valuable, let's say it gives it greater rights or greater benefits, the company might be indifferent to that. That's an individual harm. There's no such argument made here. If I could just make sure I respond to two other points here. This issue of judicial estoppel. I think the court's questions were going towards this, but there's no inconsistency whatsoever in the positions that were taken here. Our position in the Shirazi case was not that PE Chicago didn't have standing, that the claims belonged to someone else. It was that the claims failed to satisfy their essential elements. Now we are saying that the claims belong to the company, and they rise or fall on those merits and those essential elements as brought already by the company. There's no inconsistency there whatsoever. And to take the appellant's argument to its logical extension, they would be saying that any time the corporation loses, it's open season for the shareholders to bring a case. Now, I think counsel's argument is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of question two under Tooley. The question two under Tooley is, who is entitled to relief? And what Masuda's counsel say is, that basically means if the company loses, Katie bar the door. Everybody can sue because they weren't entitled to relief. That is false. What the second test of Tooley is saying is, in this case, in Dr. Masuda's case, who would be entitled to the money if she wins? So let's look at that based on her allegations here. She alleged that not enough money was paid for PE Chicago's asset to PE Chicago. If a court were to decide that that's the case, who would get that money? It would be PE Chicago. It would not be an 11% shareholder in a parent company. And if the court were to decide that there was a meaningful harm from the fact that part of the purchase price was put in a personal account of the controlling shareholder rather than in the corporate account that he controlled, who would get that benefit? Clearly, the check would not be cut to Dr. Masuda as a minority shareholder above, as it might be in a case where you're talking about voting rights or something like that. So it's just a misunderstanding of prong two. Very, very briefly on the fraud claim, I think the Chief Judge's questions went to exactly the core of the problem with their argument. The judge found that Dr. Masuda failed to allege the essential elements, most importantly, an intent to induce reliance. And the point that's critical here is this cold call from Dr. Masuda to Panda, in which the statement, the only statement at issue here, was allegedly made that her shares were worthless, was made, admittedly, based on the complaint, a month before the transaction was even envisioned. Of course she hasn't alleged that it was intended to induce her reliance to not protect her interest in the transaction, because the transaction was not yet even conceived. It didn't even exist. So they were given leave to amend to better plead their fraud claim. They chose to stand on their current fraud claim, and it doesn't satisfactorily plead, let alone with particularity, the elements of fraud.
Is there anywhere that I can find or we can find where the money went as a result of the release, the consideration of the release? Obviously, Serrazzi got a big verdict. This is what the settlement was about.
Right.
And so assume he got money. The question is, did PE get money?
Well, Your Honor, candidly.
And where maybe at least that Ms. Masuda would have some place to go to find her money, if there is any.
Right. Candidly, I think counsel, since counsel were the same for PE Chicago and Serrazzi, would be in a better position to answer that. But let me really focus on that, because I think it's a great question. With respect to PE Chicago, presumably she either received her 11%, or she has a claim against them for the 11%, or maybe the allegations of the complaint aren't entirely accurate and she's not really entitled to 11%, but they would be in a better position than I to address that. With respect, if I may, just to Mr. Serrazzi, I think your concern about who keeps that money is exactly why this court must follow Tooley and make the claim reside within PE Chicago. If Shirazi's point is, hey, I brought these tort claims, that's my cash. You know, I argued the overpayment, but you other shareholders, you don't get anything. That's exactly why corporate harm claims must be recovered first and foremost by the company, so that the company can then distribute the funds fairly.
Well, I thought he was combined the two at some point, where it's he and the company.
They may well have, Your Honor, and certainly counsel's in a better position to address that. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. I'll give you one more minute. I think you were getting low on time, but
thank you, Your Honor.
Wrap up.
Counsel hit the nail on the head. We tried to do it with the company. He says, who's entitled to relief? The company should be entitled to relief. We brought the claim initially in the Serrazzi case on behalf of the company. And what did he say? Their argument was that the company doesn't have a claim. Why? Because they participated in the transaction. Whereby Dr. Masuda, a minority innocent shareholder, is just left without remedy because she can't sue and the company can't sue. And finally, on the settlement issue, PE Chicago just assumes Serrazzi never happened. P. PE Chicago could be sitting right there in that table, not settling, not suing. It doesn't matter because our claims are distinct. That's exactly what the Delaware Supreme Court said. Regardless of any claim that the company has, a minority shareholder's claims in this situation are unique, and she is entitled to sue directly.
We would respectfully did PE Chicago get any money in the settlement?
Not on the tort claims. They got money on, you know, the generic, we settle all claims that we may ever have.
I mean, was there any money in transferred to that company where theoretically at least she would have had, you know, some kind of an interest or claim or something?
It's my understanding, generally speaking, that it's the breach of contract claim because there are two claims. One was Mr. Sirazi, which, by the way, sued individually and directly, his tort claims, and then the company's breach of contract claim. That's the total that was settled in that case. So we would just respectfully ask that the court reverse the district court and allow the claims to proceed, or if we need to amend our pleading to show that there actually was a voter dilution because of what happened, we'd be given leave to amend our pleading.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both
counsel.
We'll take the case under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.